My personal motivation is that I'm a person and I've watched over 10,000 people be murdered by Israel, and I can't sit at home and watch that happen, and this is the best action I can think of doing, getting in the way of the actual weapons being made and sent to Israel to kill those people with.
And so can you tell me about this factory and why this is the target?
Yeah, so this is a BAE factory, so they are making essential components for weapons that are used by Israel to kill Palestinians. Part of their fighter jets comes directly from this factory, and that's allowing bombs to be dropped on Palestinian children, mothers, fathers, hospitals, and we are literally trying to stop them from producing things today. So we're asking workers to turn around when they come to the gate, which they've been doing, and we're trying to stop any vans, deliveries and any pickups from the factory getting in and out.
What do you tell the workers when they come in?
Please, like, hear our message. Like, I don't think you as a person want to be responsible for this. Something that we're trying to do is just take that responsibility out of their hands and say, you know, this is an action that's getting in the way. You're not going to be penalised if you turn around and go home, because we're physically not letting you through.
And what are you hoping the sort of picket will achieve? Like, as well as it being communicative and, like, saying we're here to stop this, are you hoping it will have, like, a sort of physical effect?
It's a very practical purpose, to stop weapons getting in and out, and to stop workers getting in and out, to be honest, as well, because we want this factory to be as unfunctionable as possible today. It's great to go on marches, and I would encourage all people to go on the march tomorrow and every other march that goes on, but it's also important to have concrete material effects on the Israeli regime, and one of the ways we can do that is by blocking factories like BAE Systems here, like Elbit Systems, who have over 50 factories in this country, like Lockheed Martin. Any factory, any arms dealer that exists in this country has weapons that are going to Israel, has weapons that are going to all other sorts of countries where they shouldn't be going. So the important thing is to stop the weapons getting in and out, disrupt the supply chain, disrupt the docks. I encourage all dock workers to not load weapons onto ships like they've been doing in Belgium, like they've been doing in Barcelona, like they've been doing in Tacoma in the US. It's about the very practical materiality of stopping weapons, or slowing down the progress of weapons getting from this country to Israel.
So you're encouraging other people to
100%. I know there was a very, very principled activist literally hanging onto the side of a boat in Tacoma to stop it taking off. I know there's workers there that have refused to load weapons. Whether you're a worker and you want to refuse to load weapons, or whether you want to physically block these buildings, I would encourage as many people as possible to do it. They are all over the country. I know there are Elbit factories in Kent. I know there are Elbit factories in Bristol. I think there's at least three in Leicester. I'm sure there's plenty of others. Yeah, I'm actively encouraging anyone who shows solidarity to the Palestinian people. If you've got a day off, if you've got a day off during the week, if you don't work, if you work weekends, so you've got the time off, if you're a student, get down and block these factories. I couldn't encourage it more.
And this is sort of becoming like a rolling movement, isn't it? Because there was there was one a couple of weeks ago in Kent, and will there be more organised by this group, workers?
Of course, absolutely. We're hoping that this will inspire more. We know this was inspired by other movements that have already happened. What I would say is we have twice as many people as we had last time, so it is a growing movement. We hope to have twice as many next time. We've got at least, I think, 400 today. Last time we had 150. So that tells you that it's a growing movement. That tells you that people want to get involved, and we're expecting to see more people on the march tomorrow for the PSC march tomorrow. Every group, and I am preaching this from a position of we need unity, whether it's PSC, whether it's Palestine Action, whether it's us today, whether it's any trade union that's supporting Palestine. Every single movement that is backing Palestine needs to unite together and fight to ensure that Palestine is free. Because it's not even just a ceasefire, it's the fact that Israel has been occupying Palestinian land for 75 years. This is an ongoing genocide. It did not start on October 7th, and we need to hammer that point home. It did not start on October 7th.
Welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith, and in the nick of time, David Slavik, my co-host, has joined the stream. David, how are you doing?
It's a wonderful morning here in Newfoundland. The sun's very barely cracked, but daylight savings time. What are you going to do about it?
We're back in the Gaza war room. One in every 200 people in Gaza has been killed over the past month and a bit. All telecom services in the Gaza Strip have been put out of action as we speak. This after 7,000 people were put under near total siege in the Al-Shifa hospital over the last few days. The probable war crimes just keep piling up. We're all expected to sit here watching this extraordinary demolition of human life, infant life, infrastructure, and any idea that this region can hope to function in the future. We've got a couple of listener favorites back on the show. Ollie Haynes, our man in the movements, his coverage of the Gilets Jaunes and the other forms of protest and resistance to the Macron regime in France has been invaluable. He's bringing it all back home to cover protests and forms of resistance to Britain's role in the Israeli project here in Britain. And from Declassified, Britain's premier critical foreign policy blog and investigative journalism hub, we've got Matt Kennard back on the program. Gentlemen, welcome to the Popular Show.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be back.
Great to have everyone in. We've been talking this week about the importance of these weekly demonstrations and protests every Saturday. I'll be at the Manchester one tomorrow, so come and say hello if you're there. I know you guys will be in London. But as well as these demonstrations, which are a very important kind of role in producing solidarity and influencing public opinion, we've also been seeing some more novel and direct forms of action. Last week in the States, the Tukwila Boeing Military Delivery Center was subject to protest and attempts to block weaponry being manufactured in the US for use in Israel. And we also saw last Friday down in Kent, here in the UK, a subsidiary company of Elbit Systems, which produces military equipment to be exported
BAE
and used
systems.
By Israeli forces, BAE Systems as well. Okay,
this one was BAE, yeah.
Was also subject to protest. Ollie, you were there. Maybe we can bring you in first on what was going on down there.
Yeah, sure. Just to apologise to your listeners, I'm hoping that the fact that I'm ill gives me a kind of sexy, gravelly voice as opposed to like squelchy. As I
we're entering the season of nasal broadcasting, Ollie. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I was there. It was organised by a coalition of trade unionists called Workers for Palestine, who've been organising blockades of factories. So they hit Instro Precision, which is a subsidiary of Elbit Systems, 2 weeks prior to last week. But the one last week was BAE Rochester, which manufactures the active interceptor systems for the F-16 and F-35 planes, which are being used in the bombardment of Gaza. So basically, they got up very early in the morning, got a coach down, set up 2 blockades at the factory entrances, and stopped workers from going in, basically, and turned them away. And for the most part, you know, workers, some of the workers were a bit annoyed. Some of them were quite congenial. One of them actually told me that he thought that the protesters had a point, which I thought was interesting. Because not everything that they do at this factory is military. A lot of it is for commercial airlines. So I don't think everyone that's involved in making this necessarily agrees with the fact that they are sort of contributing to the war machine. But yeah, this is a relatively kind of new thing. So what we've seen before this is Palestine Action, who are like sort of small, hardcore direct action protesters who target Elbit Systems only, and they, because Elbit Systems makes the drones that surveil the Gaza Strip and bombard the Gaza Strip. And they tend to break into factories, damage the air conditioning units, or damage the equipment itself. So that's like the sort of most hardcore end of the spectrum. But what Workers for Palestine has been doing is trying to mobilize more and more people. So there was 400 people at the last one, and they're hoping to get more people at the next one to block the factories and kind of start rolling disruption of the supply chain, basically.
Matt, have you been impressed with the kinds of activism and participation that we've been seeing in the UK over the past month and a bit, and what significance do you impute to it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's massively impressive just listening to Ollie there. I mean, I think that we've got to a point now where that is what is needed. We need mass civil disobedience because, as you mentioned in your opening, this is unprecedented in terms of just the brazen nature of the atrocities and the brazen nature of the war crimes. They are advertising what they're doing, and they are specifically going after kids and civilians. I mean, this is a war. This is a slaughter. It's not a war. And it's not a war. It's definitely not a war on Hamas. It's a slaughter of innocent people that have nothing to do with Hamas. So I think that, and obviously we've seen in recent weeks, it's been very revealing of our own political systems, hasn't it? In the United States, in the UK, and in Europe as well, that we've had our leaders, bipartisan, coming out in support of what Israel is doing. And I think it's not extravagant to call it a genocide. It is a genocide. When you're targeting civilians for who they are, because they're Palestinians, not because they're affiliated to Hamas, not because they're militants, just because they're Palestinians, then it's a genocide and they're killing. And so I think that when our leaders aren't doing are backing that, when we have no other means really of influencing them apart from going out on the streets, then we need to turn to new measures and smashing up arms companies that are complicit in this and arming the Israelis is the obvious thing to do, and also do what Workers for Palestine do, just demonstrate outside. We need to problematize these supply chains, because the other thing is these things that how these industries want these things to work is no one really knows about it. It all just operates under the radar. These companies that they have nice corporate offices, they have nice PR teams that present these nice portfolios about what they do. They don't want directly to be linked to mangled children, which is actually what the result of their trade is. So we need to make sure everyone knows what is going on and how Britain is an integral part alongside Washington. But Washington's obviously the most important player in terms of backing the Israelis, but Britain's up there as well. So we have a responsibility in this jurisdiction, which we should all feel, to do everything we can to stop it, because we need a ceasefire. We've needed a ceasefire for a long time, but every day we're not calling for a ceasefire and not pushing for a ceasefire, hundreds more children are dying. That's the reality. And that's not just rhetoric. They bombed Jabalia refugee camp yesterday again. They're obviously conquering a hospital in Al Shifa with all the horror that brings. So we need it now. I support anyone who's doing everything they can in terms of civil disobedience. I think that also we need to bank this feeling and bank this awareness that people are getting. It's revealing a lot about our society, which has stayed hidden, and we need to bank that, because this obviously this is a massive horror that everyone's seeing, but there's been many other horrors that we've supported over the decades that have been done silently. And I'll just finish with this. One of them, I won't talk too much about this, obviously, because we want to focus on Gaza, but one of them, which we've done a lot of work on in recent years, is the war in Yemen, or the war on Yemen.
Yeah,
the Saudi war in Yemen, which raged from 2015 to quite recently, actually. And that was Britain again was massively involved in backing that. And actually, we made a film at Wharton, BAE factory in Wharton, which is near Preston. And there's a flight that goes every week to Cyprus first. We got a base in Cyprus, and then on to Saudi Arabia to maintain the fleet of aircraft that were bombing Yemen. And no one knew about that. And when we told people about that, and when we went to Wharton and we were interviewing people, even in Wharton, which is a tiny little town, we were saying, do you know that, and most of the people worked in a factory, and we were saying, do you know that you're supplying the Saudis, who have basically made Yemen into hell on earth? By at the height of it, there were 2.3 million children on the brink of starvation because of a man-made famine. They were also bombing schools, hospitals. They blew up a school bus, infamously, in 2018. Anyway, so that really hit home to me how important it is that people are aware that we're a key cog in the war machine globally. And so it's really, really good what is happening. I mean, and Palestine Action is really interesting. I think it should be studied by everyone who wants to take on these forces, because they've had huge successes. Huge successes. They shut down, actually shut down arms factories.
In Oldham.
In Oldham, yeah. And it's not just about Elbit. I mean, I know they're focusing on Elbit, but if you think about an arms company now, which is having meetings and prospecting about where to locate factories, there's going to be a massive deterrent now about coming to the UK. And what better thing could there be than have a deterrent for arms companies setting up in your country? So I think Palestine Action have done us a valuable service, and hopefully it will continue going forward.
Carry
on, Ollie, please.
Oh, there's a very good article in the New Arab, just off the back of what Matt said, about it's the factory that makes the component parts of the Hermes 450 drone. I can't remember where it is in the UK, but it's an Elbit factory, or an Elbit. It's UAV Engines, which is a subsidiary of Elbit. And there's this article about how when Palestine Action sort of pointed that out to the local community it's somewhere in Kent again. Kent seems to be a real hotbed of just the war machine. They pointed out to this village in Kent, and then that started dividing the village, and people weren't happy with the fact that this kind of machinery of slaughter was sat on their doorstep.
Yeah.
I think I just, coming from a Washington D.C. background, you could see just how, like, you know, the pink washing, the green washing that goes on. When you go down to the subway, you see advertisements for missiles. And they'll say, like, the defense system, and it looks clean, and it looks so surgical. And I think it becomes background when you're in one of these towns. And, you know, Washington, D.C. is obviously the belly of the beast, right? And you just walk past these things. And then there's a Greenpeace poster after it. You know, and it just kind of becomes all the same thing. And I think as people have had to face this, they're becoming more aware. Recently, the head of sort of the arms distribution approval office, you know, the guy who had to go to Congress and say, this is why we have to sell weapons. He who was very disgusted about the Yemeni situation, he said, actually, this one is worse. So he quit last week. And he said, you know, I could justify because we're selling. And these are like these level of nuance that people get in their head. He's like, well, this air defense systems, you know, I don't want Jetta to get bombed or whatever, right? And you can see this very smart, nice guy even making those calculations himself. And then your average person who's just like, I don't know, man, like, we have houses here, jobs, so what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. David, could you say something about what your colleagues have been getting up to protesting at the DNC headquarters and the Capitol building of the
absolutely. And I think what I like about, and I think what you guys are getting at, is that we're seeing for the first time, rather than sort of like shatter spot, you know, sort of getting in the streets, we're seeing really directed protests. And just this week, some people I know and people I knew people inside the DNC building, I knew people outside the DNC building, and you could see that this desire to like actually make it hurt where it counts really happened. But one of the things that I realized is that you had, on the outside, you had very respected political reporters like Dave Weigel of Semaphore, who's formerly of the Washington Post, who I know very well. He was countering what the Democrats were saying from the inside, that they're trying to break in, that there was this violent mob, they're trying to make it about an insurgency, or the January 7th type stuff. And what was interesting about that was that it was very clear from people who were Democratic voters, you know, people who voted their whole life, they were on the outside. They weren't trying to burn down the place, you know. But what you realize is that people are getting better about framing these protests. And I think that's important too, because I think a lot of that was lost during BLM. I think it was, you know, that was a great, you know, uprising in the States. But this time people are really making the case, and they're not standing for the pushback.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see this level of mobilization, this level of pretty unprecedented distance between the elite position, the elite narrative, the elite media narrative, and both public opinion and what people are actually prepared to do to resist. I think Matt is utterly right that this has to be seen quite apart from its immediate desperate strategic kind of impetus and need to demand this ceasefire and to block as many weapons getting out as possible. It also needs to be thought of as a pretty unique opportunity to try to extend this new consciousness and this new awareness and this new kind of willingness on the part of us in the rich countries to see ourselves as actually actors in all this, not just people judging it from some sort of humanitarian distance. And actually, we need to use this to get people to see that the same applies to all these other conflicts. The same applies to all future conflicts, that we're a big cog in this whole thing, as Matt said.
Go on, Matt.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, and I mean, I think that it's really important, that point you made about this distinction between the people and the elites, which was obviously always there, but it's so acute now. It's so acute, and they're trying everything to try and cover that up. They're saying, well, when like 500,000 people come on the streets of London in the biggest march since 2003, they say, well, they're all anti-Semites and they're all racist and all Hamas supporters. You know, there's a real fear amongst the elite about that discrepancy. So they're demonizing people coming out. It won't work. And I don't think that that kind of discrepancy is tenable for that long, personally. I think that that will play out over the next months and hopefully years, because as you say, hopefully this consciousness will retain. But an interesting part of this also is we're not just sort of linked in this sort of supply chain way with the arms companies. We are an active participant in the horror that's happening in Gaza. And the amazing thing is, as a journalist, is that no newspapers are covering it. So we Declassified last week, myself and Mark Curtis did a story about how 33 RAF military transport flights had gone to Tel Aviv from the UK's base in Cyprus, which is called RAF Akrotiri. It was retained when Cyprus got independence from Britain in 1960. We've got another one as well, which is just for GCHQ and NSA. I've been there. So 33 military transport flights, and we asked the MOD what's on them. They won't tell us. So these are huge vehicles. They're called A400Ms and C-17s, huge military transport vehicles. A C-17 can carry three Black Hawk helicopters, for example, or hundreds of troops. So we have no idea what is going to Tel Aviv. We also know that the SAS is deployed to Cyprus, to that base, and is on standby related to Gaza. Now, interestingly, a D notice has been put out that the press can't report on the SAS involvement in Gaza. So they might be, that it's very likely they're in Israel, maybe probably in an advisory capacity, but it could be a combat role on the ground. We don't know. But again, no press has reported anything that we've put out, even about these military transport flights. We've got a story out this morning about how the US is secretly shipping arms to Israel via this UK base in Cyprus. So this UK base in Cyprus, RAF Akrotiri, has become, and this is the words of Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, the international hub for the international military effort to support Israel. Zero coverage in the mainstream media. So it's kind of amazing, isn't it, that we are implicated in a attack and a slaughter that is the ICC should close down if it doesn't investigate Netanyahu and his henchmen for this. But we're massively implicated in that in ways that we don't even understand, that a functioning media could probably find out if they put some reporters on it. But there's nothing. And they all abide by the Dean. I'm pretty sure it's because there's a D notice out, and I think these military transport flights, is highly likely that the SAS is on a lot, is on some of them, as well as we don't know what else. So it's exposing the political system, where you have 525 MPs, this is in the UK, voting against or abstaining on a ceasefire in Gaza 40 days into a slaughter of children. But it's also exposing the media. It's massively exposed the media in ways that I've never come across. Like the Israeli propaganda, everyone makes fun of it, and it is preposterous, all of it. They literally lie every time they open their mouths. But if you read the BBC and The Guardian and others, and they're sort of meant to be the good ones, they just regurgitate it all. And that is so, so important. And we need to understand that makes them complicit in what is happening. Ahmed Al-Nouk, who is a brilliant Palestinian journalist from Gaza, who's in London now, and I've become good friends with him in the last month or so. His whole family were wiped out 3 weeks ago. Every single person, his dad, his two sisters, his three brothers, their 13 children, all under 13, all wiped out in one bomb, targeted. And he says, the Western media killed my family. That's what he says. That's his perception, because they give them the cover to do what they're doing. I keep saying this, but I do think nothing will be the same after this, because they've had to trash the system to support this. They've had to make it so obvious what everything's about that I really don't think it can go back to status quo ante after this.
Yeah, we live in a time where our governments are increasingly acting with impunity. They thought that they'd defeated the populist uprisings of the long 2016. They thought they'd brought the kinds of protesters that they do approve of in-house and discredited the rest of them. But you can only act with impunity for so long without, as Matt says, trashing the system and trashing any faith in official information. We're really on a speed run as far as that's concerned. I mean, one thing we've said on the show is that it seems likely that our power brokers are going to regret some things about how the Ukraine war was managed in its early stages. There was a kind of bizarre way in which normal people were encouraged to participate in the propaganda effort in a pretty unprecedented way. You've got to have a Ukrainian flag, you've got to take an active interest in this and supporting NATO, you've got to spot the Putinists in our ranks. And in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, they sort of tried to play the same game with Israel. We're going to have Israeli flags flying in public buildings. We're going to have this big sort of social media effort to get people to see Israel in this equivalently moralized kind of, it's compulsory to be seen to support it sort of way. But actually, it seems like that project was a big mistake, and maybe they didn't anticipate the sheer amount of video that we're seeing coming out of Gaza this time round, unlike previous similar incursions. And I don't know, do other people feel that actually the propaganda effort has completely slipped through Israel's fingers and the fingers of its Western allies, and that something very unpredictable indeed is going on here?
I mean, completely. I mean, I've been to a lot of these protests, and the striking thing about them is the just number of like ordinary people who are there who are not, not that I've got anything against sort of like regular hardcore anarchists or activists or whatever, but some of them, you expect them, yeah, you expect them to be at this kind of thing. But you go out on the streets in London, or in fact, I live in a small town in Oxfordshire, and there was a protest on the steps of our town hall last Sunday, and it's just ordinary people who are going on their phones, seeing footage of slaughter, and knowing instinctively that we have something to do with it, or at least that our politicians are not condemning it and not trying to stop it, and are getting out to try and stop that happening. What I am kind of interested in is the degree to which maybe the left should have possibly, if not supported NATO, obviously, but was the left not humanitarian enough? And so there was a piece in Compact arguing that the left was correctly coldly rational on Ukraine and has become hysterical humanitarians over Palestine. I almost think the opposite is true, that maybe we should have been a little bit more humanitarian over Ukraine, because, for example, like Bruno Macais, the former Portuguese foreign minister, he's recently divided the world up into what he sees as four quarters of kind of ideology, which is the Westernists, i.e. people who think only Western lives matter, pro-Ukraine, anti-Palestine, the anti-Westernists, he says, who think Ukrainian lives don't matter, but Palestinians do, the nihilists and the something else. But I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts about whether or not we maybe should have but leftists should have given a bit more credence to the kind of liberal language around Ukraine in order to then make the case here, or whether that's completely off base.
Matt made the case on this show on his previous appearance that it wasn't so much a case of feeling the right feelings about Ukrainians. It was about being hard-headed about what the likely effect of flooding the region indiscriminately with weapons was likely to be. I don't know, Matt, do you want to answer Ollie's provocation?
Yeah, I mean, there's two parts to that. One is, I don't think it would have mattered what we said about Ukraine in terms of this, because there's so many influences on why Israel has such blanket support across the political class. So I don't think that anything would have given us the tools to really fight back against that in a real sense. In terms of Ukraine, I mean, I oppose the invasion of Ukraine. I also think that the Ukrainians have a right to expel the invaders. But it's complicated, isn't it? Because we weren't supplying them with billions of dollars and pounds of weaponry because we care about anything I just said. It was about bogging down the Russians in a conflict that where they have sustained losses over a long period and weakening Russia. It's a great game, which Russia's playing as well, of course. But it's a great game, and that's what people don't understand. And in the great game, Israel serves some sort of function for the Western powers. I mean, this is a different point, but I've been thinking about this recently: is why do we support Israel so blanketly in Europe and the United States? There's two arguments, right? One is that it serves a geopolitical function. It's a colonial outpost. There was the mayor of Jerusalem, or the head of Jerusalem, when it was under British rule in the Mandate period, said that Israel was what he called a little Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism. So it's like this idea that we could have this little outpost that would be loyal to Britain and the United States. Back then there was much more resistance, sort of secular nationalist resistance, like Nasser in Egypt and others. But and I think that was true at one point, that it was. But my take now is just that the real reason is because of the power of the Israel lobby. And I've done a lot of work on this in the British context, and it's the same in the United States. But it's so powerful in terms of the influence it has on our political system. Like we found recently, declassified, that 2/5 of Keir Starmer's cabinet are funded by the Israel lobby. 1/3 of Rishi Sunak's cabinet, including Rishi Sunak, and also in the case of Labour, including Keir Starmer as well. So, and no one talks about it. This is again something that's verboten in the corporate media. But I personally think that now Israel might be a bit of a strategic problem for the West, because that I don't know if you've seen these cables that are going back, or one that got leaked from, I can't remember where it was, from US embassy, was saying that this is potentially going to lose us the Arab public for generations, what they're supporting in Gaza. I mean, I think it probably already has. But again, the US empire owns Egypt, they own that dictator, they own every single dictator in the six Gulf states. They've obviously got Iraq under control, not Afghanistan and not Iran. But basically, they don't have any problem with having landing strips in that region, right? The Gulf states are completely under control. So the idea they desperately need this tiny little country, which is like population is the same as London, to enforce their will, I don't really buy it anymore.
Is it a product of the fact that they're a kind of gerontocracy now, and so they're governed by people for whom Israel has been this vitally important lodestar in the region for decades, but they can't see that the winds have changed because they're like, everyone that governs America is ancient and in some cases literally dying in post?
You know what I think it is? I just think that it's like, because of the Holocaust and because of the nature of the history of persecution of the Jewish people, there's a real fear, which is understandable, about exposing and doing journalism about the Israel lobby, because it feeds into historical tropes, whatever. So you've got this monster, if it was a set, if APAC was, I mean, APAC people do talk about, but there's a lot of other elements of it. And the other interesting thing about the a lot of Israel lobby groups is they put Jewish in the title, so it becomes even harder to criticize. Like the Board of Deputies of British Jews, right, which is a Israel lobby group. And I don't just say that, again, I'll qualify that by saying I've been through the records of their meetings with the UK government, and they're talking, it's explicitly about lobbying for Israel. It's an Israel lobby group. But when they put Jewish in the title, people feel like a bit reticent to say, well, this is an Israel lobby group, and criticize it, which it's all understandable, but that needs to change, because that's why I think this monster has been allowed to build up, because it's not exposed. And now, I'll just finish with this, where Biden is going up to a podium and literally ventriloquizing for the Israeli government. Completely absurd stuff. So they tell him what to say. This is apparently the most powerful man in the world. Apparently he's not anymore. But he goes up and says, well, I've seen pictures of 40 dead babies, beheaded babies, when he hasn't, because that hadn't happened. He went up yesterday and said, well, I've seen evidence that Al-Shifa Hospital has a Hamas command center at the bottom, which it didn't. So he's literally being fed lines. And it's quite amazing to have a situation where you have the most powerful man, probably in the history, well, one of the most powerful men in the history of the world, who's basically just spouting out bullshit on behalf of a tiny little country in halfway across the world. Anyway.
I would say that, like, to say that he's a puppet would be giving him too much moral credence. I think that he's actively worked against the interests of the Palestinian people as a career move from the very beginning, from back when he was sharp. You know, I remember talking, I met him briefly a few years ago, and he was a sharp guy back then, like during the Obama administration. You know, he's older, you know, just like anybody gets a little older, they lose a step here and there. But he's been very fairly intentional about this. And I think that he has, like, sort of cleansed his soul of any moral clarity. And so that when he does get bullshit, it fills the vessel up perfectly, you know. So I don't even want to give him that much credit.
It was remarkable to see how quickly Ukraine was dropped as the object of interest as soon as Israel arrived as a priority. But I think Matt's onto something extremely interesting in pointing out that, in fact, Israel is becoming much more expendable to the material realities of US interests. Okay, we have, as Ollie pointed out, this elderly elite in America that still has this kind of theological faith and belief in Israel that's bipartisan for different reasons for the two parties. But actually reality is catching up. And in fact, you know, Ulster is a good comparison. You know, who in the British elite regards Northern Ireland as anything other than a sort of albatross around its neck? All sides of the Brexit debate regarded Northern Ireland as just an absolute pain in the neck, full of incredibly irritating people on the Protestant side. The kind of pro union people in Britain don't care about Ulster anymore. And is it going the same way with Israel? And does that account for the frankly pathological and crazy behavior of the state? It's very easy to blame all this on the Israeli far right, very easy to put this down to Netanyahu's own individual personality quirks, but a country that reportedly ignores the fact that this attack was predicted, you know, people have their own views on and will no doubt find out more information about how far October 7th was allowed to happen by some parts of the Israeli regime, we will see, and then responds with this unprecedented scale of devastation and destruction, this kind of supermarket sweep, kind of rushing into Gaza, destroying as much infrastructure and human life as possible, because on some level they suspect they're not going to be allowed to do it next time.
Yeah, I think there's something in that. I think that the completely loyal support that they've got is from the West forever, basically. Although it's got much worse in recent years. I put that down to the Israel lobby, by the way, because of the increase in power. But I think that has allowed them to get into a psychology where anything is permissible. because it's the same as a school ground bully, right? If you have a school ground bully who is beating up kids, and there's no red lines put on them by a teacher, they basically just say keep going. What's the reaction going to be? The school ground bully is going to take it to the next level. It's going to beat up more kids. Going to beat them up harder. And I think that's exactly what's happening. I don't know how it could get any worse in Gaza. I mean, it can't get worse. They are bombed. They're literally conquering hospitals and snipering people who are moving between hospital buildings and cutting oxygen to premature babies. It's literally hell on earth. Or as Mads Gilbert, the Norwegian doctor who worked in Gaza, said, it's worse than hell on earth. It is a horror, a chamber of horrors. So, and still, we're going up on a podium, our leaders, and saying we support them. So that is the natural reaction to that. I think just to go back to your point about whether this at some stage it might be expendable, and that's why I don't know because I think it's going to be I think this will change a lot. I think what we're seeing will change a lot, especially as Ollie mentions, with young people and especially young Jewish people as well, because I think the real problem for Israel is that they sell themselves as representing worldwide Jewry, which they don't, and that's an anti-Semitic idea in itself, because my dad's Jewish. I want nothing to do with that with Israel. I think that is anti-Semitic to put me in the same bracket as that state, but they are trying to do that. And I think that a lot of young Jewish people are looking at what is happening and looking at Gaza and just being like, how the hell are they doing this in my name? And I think that will play out over the next 10, 20 years. And I think that's very important as well, because the bedrock of Israeli propaganda is that Jews will not be safe without Israel. Now, if young Jews are saying, we don't want Israel and it doesn't make us safe, in fact, it makes us less safe, then the whole project will collapse. And that's kind of why there's this big move now amongst the sort of right wing to say anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism. It's very obvious why that's being pushed a lot now, because they know that they're losing control of the narrative and they need to park it with anti-Semitism to stop people speaking out, and it won't work. I mean, you're seeing it now. I have noticed, I'll just finish with this, that everyone's a lot freer speaking about this stuff than they've ever been. Like, I feel it myself. I feel liberated now in terms of it. I'm not second guessing myself about if some Zionist troll is going to accuse me of being an anti-Semite. I get basically 700 messages a day calling me a Nazi and an anti-Semite, but no one cares anymore. Yeah.
It's like in Britain, it's like the James Franco meme, the Coen brothers thing up on the gallows first time. A lot of us were reticent during the Corbyn years, you know, to be parochial for a second. Should we talk about the Israel lobby? Should we say this about the nature of the Board of Deputies, Jewish Chronicle, etc.? You know, we've been through that. And at that time round, okay, what was at stake was getting our preferred prime minister. This time, something quite different is at stake. We're having to see daily what the outcome of this repression, this decades-long project, as Tony Lehrman described on this show, scroll back for that one, a decades-long project of making, of representing criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. There's been a concerted, deliberate, well-funded, organized project. We had a kind of big hit of it in the Corbyn years, and to some extent they've kind of expended that. They've kind of lost credibility on that, just as they need it most in order to try to, you know, cover up this appalled feeling that the vast majority of people have in response to the kind of things they're seeing.
Well, I think that also explains why some of the most sort of vicious hit pieces that have been run have been against anti-Zionist Jews. If you go to any one of these protests, there's always a huge Jews Against Genocide block or Jews for Peace block or whatever. Like, and people in fully Orthodox dress marching, taking selfies with Muslims. Like, I think those people are getting very, very like angrily demonized by the tabloid media. And that is because Israel is losing the kind of propaganda war for the like hearts and minds of Jews internationally. And I think, obviously not every, I've got no insight into what every single Jew in Britain thinks, but it does seem that a lot of Jewish people in this country do not identify with that state anymore, if they ever did.
Yeah. Well, if we've covered some of the ways in which Israel seems to be losing its grip on the narrative, if we needed any proof of that, we had it in an extraordinary story that was doing the rounds yesterday about what is happening on TikTok. Let me drop a couple of clips here.
This morning I read Letter to America, which is Osama bin Laden's letter to America explaining why he attacked Americans. And I am ashamed to say that I not only have never read this letter, but I didn't even know this letter existed. It's wild, and everyone should read it. If you haven't read it yet, read it. However, be forewarned that this has left me very disillusioned, and I feel the same exact way I felt when I was deconstructing Christianity. I feel a little bit just confused, like I have entered into another timeline. What is this? And yeah, so go read it.
So I just read A Letter to America, and I will never look at life the same. I will never look at this country the same. Please read it, and if you have read it, let me know if you are also going through an existential crisis in this very moment, because in the last 20 minutes, my entire viewpoint on the entire life I have believed and I have lived has changed. Please read that entire letter.
I need everyone to stop what they're doing right now and go read.
There are thousands of these things. Not okay, TikTok, you've got to take it with a pinch of salt to some extent. There may be factors we're not seeing, but it seems to be genuine that thousands of Zoomers have read Osama bin Laden's letter to America explaining why he did 9/11, published in 2002. Seamus Milne, friend of the show, published that when he was the editor of Comment Is Free. He would later be Jeremy Corbyn's chief of top advisor, whatever. The Guardian have taken the Osama bin Laden letter down from their websites after all of this reaction. I mean, it's one thing to have lost the Zoomers on Israel. It's quite another to have lost them on the subject of Osama bin Laden and 9/11. Extraordinary scenes, gentlemen.
I mean, Matt will know more about this than me. If they removed that because it's now, is that now like encouraging terrorism under the Terrorism Act? Because I know there's been like a sort of uptick of journalists getting detained under Schedule 7 recently, and they've sort of strengthened the Terrorism Act. Is that why they've removed it, or have they just removed it because they don't want people?
They're just cowards, I think.
It shows how much the Guardian has changed. Matt, we discussed this last time you were on. You know, go back to 2002. And frankly, an amazing troll. When you could still look at it, they actually had a picture of Osama bin Laden in the columnist like columnist portraits, as if he'd actually written it for the Guardian. So Milne does have a wit about it. Very serious.
Someone said that I thought this was quite funny. They said, you know, I really was supportive of Osama bin Laden until I found out he was a Guardian columnist.
I think that it does link with what we've seen as what we're seeing now, because I don't know, it seems like a long time ago now, but I think it was like early on in the Gaza bombardment that they sacked Steve Bell, who is one of their cartoonists for like 30 or 40 years. He's a brilliant cartoonist. He did a cartoon of Netanyahu, I can't remember, slicing up Gaza or something, and apparently it was had an anti-Semitic trope in it. So they didn't just get rid of the cartoon, they sacked him. They're just cowards. And as you say, it does, it's interesting that they would have published that in 2002, because There's absolutely no way they'd do anything like that now. The spectrum, I mean, obviously the spectrum for including Osama bin Laden in the debate is the extreme end of it. But anyway, but even further back towards the centre, there's very, very little dissent you can get in The Guardian. And I actually think that The Guardian is, along with the BBC, is more nefarious than the right-wing billionaire control media, because people think that they're getting the truth from these places, and they're getting a very sanitized view of the world. And it's, and Israel is a very good example of how the liberal media is used, because The Guardian, I don't know if you guys read, sorry, I know this is off the topic of Bin Laden, I'll come back to that, but I don't know if you read that, you know, when that Israel bombed Al-Ali Hospital and then claimed it was an errant Hamas rocket. This was before they started bombing hospitals every day. And
I'm old enough to remember when it was anti-Semitic to claim that Israel would ever dream of bombing a hospital.
Yeah, and Guardian did their open source intelligence analysis of it, and they quoted someone from RUSI, which is a think tank funded by the US State Department and arms companies and stuff. And there was another one from the Atlantic Council, I think, which again is funded by NATO and arms companies and all the rest of it. And they suggested it was Hamas. But they based it effectively on the testimony of these two corrupted analysts. And that is important, because if people are reading, They get the Telegraph and whatever, but if they're reading The Guardian, they're, oh well, if The Guardian thinks that it was Hamas, then of course it's Hamas. I think that we need to, as we're saying, people are braver now about speaking out again about the Israel lobby. We need to be braver about talking about the liberal media, because there's a feedback loop which works, and people don't talk about The Guardian because a lot of prominent leftists want to maintain their access to that platform. So you don't ever get them talking about it. It's basically us at Declassified in terms of doing investigations and stuff of it. So that needs to change. So I think that the context is that they're a cowardly, captured establishment-friendly institution now, and they probably panicked that this might make them look like they're supporting Bin Laden or something like that. I mean, I'll just finish with this, actually. Another interesting part of this is that Jonathan Friedland, who used to be the executive comment editor at The Guardian, he's now one of their senior columnists. He revealed recently, I think it was recently, that he's an old friend of Mark Regev. Now, Mark Regev is a senior advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu. And Regev is also the man that us people in Britain have had on our screens for years defending the mass murder of children. He's from 2009, 2014, every one of those conflicts, they throw him up. He was also ambassador in the UK. So Jonathan Reedon said he was an old friend of his, and he said he thought he did a very, very professional job when he was in London with the representing apartheid Israel. So that's the paper. That's what the paper is. So people need to wake up and boycott it. That's my take. And I know that people don't like me saying that, but I will say it. Because we need to boycott it, because it is, and we need to boycott the BBC as well.
That journey from 2002 to the present, that is 20 years of the so-called liberal centre in Britain hardening and hardening. That it is a reminder that there was a kind of minimum level of free speech expected, and back then The Guardian was always getting in trouble. I remember people always complaining about what outrageous, unpatriotic thing they'd done. This is a story that needs to be told, really. Like, things got so reactionary actually after it was clear that the Iraq war had failed, and that this, what Mark Fisher used to call the pro-bombing left, became so central to all of Britain's liberal platforms and mouthpieces. The Corbyn period was a huge humiliation to them. And now they are the most Atlanticist people. They are the most pro-war people. And, well, they've got control of the Labour Party, apart from anything else. That is what we're up against. David, I did want to squeeze in a little bit more of Democratic Party politics. It strikes me, watching those TikToks, it is the exact same manner as the kinds of social media production that we were seeing during Black Lives Matter, the same kind of tone, the same like little personal journey of how I've become woke, but now applied to the most extraordinary content of Osama bin Laden. The Biden administration, the Biden campaign, saw it as convenient to sort of bring BLM and to some extent Time's Up and Me Too in-house as a way of countering Bernie. Like, okay, we've got progressive credentials too. Do you think that there are people in the Democratic Party who are sort of regretting getting into bed in that way now that they've basically got a tranche of millennial employees coming up in the party who think very differently to how they think?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I would say that's true. Yes, that they are. There is a difference in generationally. However, there is a the type of people who eventually get access to power are often the people who are most likely to be deferential to it. I think that that's like an iron rule of sort of organizations. And one thing that was most really telling is that the Democratic staffers who answer the phones for the constituents and, you know, open the letters that get written to the congressman, they were quite surprised because they had been told this received wisdom from their bosses, from the senior staffers. Oh, don't worry about this. And they wrote them little scripts and they said, you know, we, you know, like someone would call about Palestine. And then one example was that they called about their own family being killed. And the script said, we stand with Israel, you know, against the, you know, atrocities of Hamas on October 7th. And she said, there's no room. I'm not allowed to say I'm sorry here, but I'm going to say it. And, you know, those little micro stories, I think, are the ones that are actually breaking people because they realize they're like, oh, I'm in a position where I you know, this is on me, right? Because all of this, like, dirty work gets downloaded to the people at the bottom, right? They're, you know, it's very rare that politicians actually have to face people. And it's even more rare now, right? In the U.S., the politicians are in Congress are on the phone 2 hours a day calling for donations. They're not 2 hours a day calling constituents saying, hey, what do you need? You know, so they get one side and they're insulated. But you do see these sort of staffers. What you're also seeing is the quick retribution against more vocal people who would have been the next generation. So we're kind of seeing a killing it in the crib sort of mentality go on towards the newer activists now. Because I know that had they had Elizabeth Warren as president, maybe this would have all been a cultural match, right? You know, sort of like, you know, sort of the you know, I'm going to pull up this color just to show you, like, this is the vibe, right? You know, this sort of like sort of pink turquoise sort of new Democratic Party that we're developing here. That would have been a cultural match. And she would have had sort of the gravitas or like the understanding of how to work and manage those type of people. Joe Biden doesn't. You know, and he is very clear about that. And he doesn't think the party's changed because he hasn't changed. And I think that you're going to see, a lot more defections, and you're going to see a lot of sort of like disaffected people. I don't necessarily buy the idea that Biden won't win. Because I think people have Trump derangement syndrome bad enough that, you know, that's the case. But it sure as hell going to be close.
Yeah.
Can I comment on something? Yeah, well, it's interesting in what Matt was saying about The Guardian. I mean, my dad sells old magazines and newspapers. He got a stack of newspapers a while ago that were from just before and then just after 9/11. And I was flicking through them. And in The Guardian, like the day after 9/11, you had Saskia Sassen saying it was blowback. And it's just like, you just can't imagine that now.
That's insane, that's absolutely crazy. Saskia Sassen in The Guardian.
My dad's an artist, and he used to have some like pictures in the Guardian, and so I was looking through his archives recently and was looking at some articles that weren't related to his art, but just were in The Guardian in the 80s, and I had a similar experience. I was just reading, like, oh my God, I cannot believe this. The Guardian used to read like this. It was actually like had real up to Marxist analysis of the world, and it is amazing what's happened to it. It is, and it's happened at a time. I don't know if I mentioned this last time, James, when I was on, but it happened at a time when the media is democratized, Which is, for me, is two reverse trends. Like, you would have thought when the media is democratized and there's alternative media, the pressure that would put on the legacy media is it would have to open up more because it would, otherwise it would get outflanked. But actually, we've seen the opposite. It's become more and more closed, less and less open to dissident views. And I think that that's probably because, I don't know. I can't really think of why that would be, but it is really insidious. It's funny. I mean, I won't name names, but even if you look at good leftists or people who have quite a good analysis of the world, if they spend like 10, 20 years on the Guardian comment pages, they almost always melt. Always. Like, if you look at, I will name a name. Look at George Monbiot.
Do
this to what we're seeing. Okay, so regardless of what he said initially about trying to equate Hamas and Israel, and I mean, that's a different debate. He's literally, I think he's done one tweet about it in a month. He definitely hasn't written a column about it. We're talking about a UK-backed genocide where 125 kids have been slaughtered every day for 40 days. And he hasn't even written a column about it. He's never written a column about Julian Assange, who's been in Belmarsh prison for 4 years. So, and Monbiot was someone I grew up really devouring his work. I really, really liked it. And I think that once that's what The Guardian does to you, he's got Guardian brain now. It's like it's hard to maintain. And it's not a director. They're not telling him what to write. But once you're in that environment for that long, it slowly changes you, I think. And I think that actually this, again, the Gaza crisis has been very revealing of a lot of prominent leftists. And their reaction to it has been very revealing of where they really stand. And I think that not doesn't just go for the left, I think it goes for the whole political system, right? We know now where people stand when there's a genocide, which we're behind and arming, supporting. We know where people stand. We need to remember that and take it forward, because those are the lines. They're the reddest of red lines. You can't, once you're back to genocide, once you're voting against the ceasefire after 6,000 kids have been killed, then there's no way back from that.
The flare has gone up. We've got some clarity. We want to see less Guardian brain out there and more Popular Show brain. Patreon.com/thepopularpod is where to go to support our work. Of course, anyone listening to this show will also want to support Matt's work at Declassified, still an absolutely invaluable resource. You can read Ollie Haynes's stuff at Navarra Media, lots of other good places, and nobody's perfect, The Guardian too. This has been a great conversation, guys, covering both the fact that in the absolute worst of circumstances, everybody I know just this thing has got into their souls. People are absolutely miserable, shaken. It's an extraordinary experience watching people just their whole kind of political outlook being transformed by just seeing these images. By the way, here's a Popular Show prediction. In about 6 months' time, there's going to be a big kind of scandal about gore on social media. It will probably be dressed up in a kind of snuff pornography, something like that. It won't be to do with this, but they do not want you seeing those images. They do not want normies sharing those images. The normies were doing it on Instagram before our clever people started doing it on Twitter. There's going to be some sort of gore scandal, and there's going to be AI blocking your posts if there's too much red in the image or whatever.
Whatever people think of him, that happens a lot to Jake Hanrahan, the war reporter at Popular Front, who gets blocked constantly for gore. I don't think it's like political censorship, but that censorship is already happening.
Some people would say there's too much red in this image right here.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Well, Matt Kennard, Ollie Haynes, thanks so much for joining us on The Popular Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks
for having us, yeah.